this on 23rd September 77.
So what kind of effects did you find?
Well, we went out in, what was it, 1958? We went out to the Iniwetok Bikini area, and we sat on a ship that we had outfitted at SRI to sit south of the region and look for field alarm echoes that might be seen from a Hiawatha Key shot that was planned for Iniwetok. Now, it turned out that shot never occurred. The thing was shut down and later moved to Johnson Island. But we went out there and had just a wonderful time playing with rheometers and got essentially nothing out of the whole business.
Hmm.
The whole operation then moved to Johnson Island. We moved that ship there too. And then they set off, what was it, Teak and Orange, two Hiawatha Key shots lifted off of Redstone rockets. All of which has nothing to do with astronomy, of course. And
well, it provides a little bit of background. We don't know the details.
It fell upon me to run the set of rheometers in 1958. And then, years and years and years later, in 1962, it was, remember, just before the test ban treaty went into effect,
right.
The U.S. popped off a whole bunch of them out there.
Right.
And the most exciting one, of course, was the Starfish shot, which was a giant, very high altitude shot. It gave most of its energy in the form of X-ray deposition, but also created a wing-dingy aurora, sort of west of Hawaii and north of Johnson Island. And my participation in that was to have a whole fleet of ships outfitted with rheometers.
I see.
But also at Johnson Island, we had a 60-foot dish scanning the aurora, the data patch, you might say. Again,
so, so it sounds like you could pretty much do anything that could use radar's ability and was broadly in the earth sciences at this stage, and it was partly astronomy. Okay.
No, I wouldn't call this astronomy.
Well, but you did partly astronomy, and that was just one of many things. Now you took a tour around Europe that you told me about before in the late 50s. What year was that now?
Well, that was 1957. That was just as I was leaving the Air Force. I had lots of vacation saved up, and I hitchhiked over on a military flight, and I met Gordon Pettengill at Frankfurt. We had planned this together, and we were going to do a tour around Scandinavia and around Europe. And we just had a great time. First went up, and we picked up a new Volkswagen at Wolfsburg, and then we visited Dwingeloo with the 83-foot dish.
Right.
And,
what did you find there? What are your memories of that visit?
Fantastic competence. I was really impressed by those guys. What they had done with what limited funds.
Mm-hmm. What particularly, the stability of the receivers, or?
Oh, I don't know. Great cleverness, I thought. Those were back in the days before we had digital converters that would switch you from polar axis over to right ascension technique, over to Azel.
Right.
But they had an Azel dish that was tracking a mechanical, you know, this beautiful thing all machined beautifully. It did all the conversions of coordinates to get them. What a terrible way to go at it nowadays. But they had, their receivers were on top at that time.
Mm-hmm. This was Mueller primarily.
Yeah, right. Yeah, very clever dish. I thought he did everything just right.
And what other radio places did you visit? Radio astronomy.
Oh, I had a very nice time with Haring and Oslo, who was studying aurora. Again, he was our chief competition. We were running neck and neck at that time, trying to see what we could figure out fastest about the Northern Lights. He had a theory we disagreed with that had to do with propagation, as if the aurora formed a sporadic E-like patch. And you could propagate it. And I think we were right in the long run, but he was a very fascinating fellow. And old Sturmer, who calculated the theories of orbits from the sun coming into the Earth.
But for radio
he had
astronomy,
more as a hobby than anything. He didn't really like that kind of work. Excuse me.
But for radio astronomy places, what else? I think Jodrell Bank.
Oh yeah, you visited? Of course that was the thing to do with Jodrell Bank. We visited there. I thought we were sort of tourists in a way. We touched base with the big dish there, which, let's see, was it running then?
I think it was almost
on
the air.
Which, of course, is a fantastic machine. We were a dog at the magnitude of this thing, but it was not really running. Well, we talked to several people there. One that impressed me a lot was was John Evans, who was doing his moon research, mm-hmm. or really winding up his moon research, having to do his thesis. And admiring what he had done with war surplus radar equipment that he'd gotten his hands on.
Was this possibly what led to Evans getting to Lincoln Labs? Was Pettengill also?
Oh, sure. Right. No, John Evans was frustrated because here was this great, big, beautiful dish being put together, but no money being put into transmitters. It was to be a radio astronomy mm-hmm. machine, and that was
right.
it. And they allowed him, I don't know, a 5-kilowatt transmitter or something small mm-hmm. to do the types of things. So he was frustrated, and he ended up leaving the country because there weren't very many other choices. And he came to Lincoln Labs, I suppose. He knew Gordon fairly well, even before we met him. Very sharp boy.
Did you visit Cambridge at all?
No.
Any other places?
No, Gordon and I were interested in radar things.
And Jodrell was the only place that was doing radar astronomy in Europe.
In England, yeah.
At that time.
Well, you could say in Europe, I guess, can't you?
I guess ever since. That's right. It's the only place that ever has done any radar astronomy in Europe.
That's right.
Except for Bay, his initial.
Right.
On the moon. Do you happen to know if he's alive? Or
I don't know.
Where?
Yeah. I don't know more than what I've read.
Yeah. Okay, so back to Stanford Research Institute. And we're up now till about 1959 or so when I have.
Well, I remember we passed through Sweden and visited the facility.
Oh, did you?
The west coast of Sweden.
Onsala.
And that's where we met Radhakrishnan.
I see, he was there then, right?
He knew Gordon Pettengill at that time. And so we got a chance to get a taste of what Sweden was like through Radhakrishnan's eyes.
I know Rad, so I sort of know what you're referring to.
Let's
see.
I'm
looking at these papers in 59. You published one in the Publications of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific on radio reflection and transmission properties of aurorae. Maybe it was just an abstract of a talk, but it's rather interesting that you were giving a talk at the ASP or publishing a paper.
How did that come about?
PASP.
I think I got invited to come up and give a talk once, and so it ended up turning into a paper.
Mm-hmm. But in general, you didn't particularly go to astronomy conferences at this time?
No, my chief of it was not having to do with ionosphere.
Right.
So Commission 3 of IRSI was the chief outlet for most of our stuff. And we've always been uncertain as to what to do. In this business of looking at the moon and aurora and hard surfaces out there, planetary surfaces, it's been frustrating always down through the years because the Commission 5 of IRSI used to be Commission 5, this is J now,
right.
Wooed us, saying, look, we're radio and radar. See, it says radar out there, but in fact, when we'd go to these things, there'd be a little knot of 20 guys that were all very fine fellows, but were not the mm-hmm. audience that we really wanted to catch. And we'd go to Commission 3, and it'd be a thundering group of people who were interested in the same types of things we were
right.
interested in. So we've never known where to put our loyalties mm-hmm. into the ionosphere.
It's never been a big enough subtopic to get its own commission, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're really caught in between a bit.
Caught in between.
Geophysics and astronomy. Yeah.
That's right.
That's not still true today. Do you know where to go to give your results now?
Well, in a way, I'm out of the field, you see.
Well, but you know what's going on anyway.
Yeah. Where does Don Campbell go? Well, he goes to astronomy tech gatherings now.
Right.
And a lot of the things that we have done here at Arecibo that are sending out of man-made signals to other planets and getting them back, initially the moon and then later other planets, has to do with things like orbital determinations of these things over long periods of time.
Surface properties.
Scatters on the surface. Yeah. Yeah, and even the troposphere, the old commission too, would say, oh, well, that's a reflection from a non-ionized media, therefore you're giving your reports in commission too, which ended up, we'd go to those and give a paper, and it would be a bunch of tropospheric propagation characters who were interested in transit horizon propagation. Microwave wavelengths, and no intelligence questions would result at all.
But now the fact that radar astronomy has found a place in amongst the astronomers, more so from what you say, is that really because now it doesn't worry about the propagation? Those things have been sorted out.
high exposure.
It's not a useful technique to probe the atmosphere.
Yes, but the radar observations of planets have gotten much, much, much better, you see.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
When I first began in this business, there was some doubt this radar business was just sort of playing around. And then they discovered very rapidly that it was very accurate. One of the things men can do best is to measure time.
Mm-hmm.
So very rapidly, it was a major way of laying down where the planets were. And then this was reinforced when we tried to fly there and discovered that the optical values were so badly off.
Mm-hmm. Now you're talking about the mid-60s. Right. So, going back to Stanford in 1960 or so, most of these papers that you were a co-author of are concerned indeed with aurorae or meteors.
Right.
There was a panel discussion on radar astronomy at a meeting in October 59 of the U.S. National Committee of IRSI, which you participated in, apparently. Do you remember that?
Didn't ring a bell.
It says that you talked on the moon and meteors and aurorae, which is a lot. And apparently it covered all aspects of radar astronomy.
Hmm.
You remember that meeting?
No. Drawing a blank. What was I doing on October 59, for goodness sakes?
Well, you were in Washington, D.C., I think, for a few days.
Okay. I was busy getting married, I think.
What do you remember?
We were down in Antigua, that's what we were doing. We were watching IRBMs re-enter. It was the same ship. We had a radar equipped and we were watching.
Okay, here's a paper in Proceedings of the IRE in 1960 with Liederbrand, in which you talk about that you get not only specular reflection, but also weak diffuse scattering from the entire moon,
mm-hmm.
which explains the earlier discrepancies between pulsed and CW observation. Yeah. Apparently that was a controversy at that time. Could you tell me about that?
Well, when Trexler was looking at the moon, he was using sharp pulses, and he would get an echo, which would come back and appear above the noise as a short spike. You could see a little trail on the trailing edge on the edge of it. But this spike didn't seem to agree with the... If you added up all the energy under that spike, it wouldn't agree with what you'd get when you ran CW, mm-hmm. which we had also been able to do. Or let's say CW, in which you transmit key down for maybe a second, and then you lift the key up and the echo comes back. That's mm-hmm. a sort of a long pulse type of reader. And that gives you quite a lot of higher sequencing. Well, what it ultimately turned out was that there's this great long tail on there that was very, very much longer than the width of this pulse that was being used. And it accounts for the missing energy
mm-hmm.
sitting there down below the noise level.
People didn't expect that there would be such a broad reflection spectrum on the moon?
Well, it was sort of... I guess what really happened was that people didn't expect such a short spike at the beginning. They didn't expect it to be quite so shiny.
I see.
I think that's the way it really went.
Expected a rougher surface.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Expected to have scatter all over the place. And then vision gets focused on what you can see in the form of a figure, and so we get attached to this fact that, wow, here's this echo coming back, specularly reflected from the front edge, it's very, very strong. Seemingly strong compared to everything else, but in fact it turns out not to be. So the moon acts sort of like a moon and the planets, except for the moons of Jupiter. All of the planets that I know about give a nice shiny echo like a Christmas tree ornament from the front edge, and a little bit of power from the rest. However, it's that little bit of power that we chase when we try to, say, map the surface of Venus.
Right.
It's scatter from the rough regions that we're looking for there.
Now,
not
the integral is not so small of this, but the intensity is weak. Am I right? Or is the integral under the wing also much less than the specular refraction?
The latter, the integral is small.
It's much smaller.
If you add up that ring of energy all the way around there, it's still smaller than the bright stuff that you get at the beginning, which makes it pretty hard to unscramble. You see, you have to remove. Part of the Dawn's problem is removing that brightness from the front edge. And that brightness is wobbling up and down in signal strength because the moon is rocking, or the planet or Venus is rocking underneath mm-hmm. you as it goes. And Venus isn't that much different from the moon. You tend to get Mercury and the moon and Venus and Mars act similarly in that most of the energy comes from the front edge.
Now, how long were you at Stanford? I guess you came down here from there?
I came down here in late 1963, last day of 1963.
Okay. Is there anything that you did relevant to radar astronomy before you came down here that we haven't touched upon?
It was mainly the moon, because we couldn't touch the planets with that machine that we had there.
You'd done the calculations and you didn't even bother trying.
Yeah, couldn't do it. So, didn't have the equipment, didn't have the backing.
Is it still the 60-foot?
Yeah. No. Let's see, then we built the 150-foot. Maybe we did that. That was afterwards. Well, now, wait a minute. I went to Scotland under the employ of SRI. And there we ran a short-term, sort of a one-year program, where we were looking at those copper frequencies, 400 and was at, scanning in a cyclic manner from Scotland, looking at the Northern Lights. That was a rather applied program in which we were trying to nail down what was the frequency of the aurora seen from that vantage point, which is pretty far north magnetically. We did a little bit of moon stuff, but we were highly pressured there to spend our time while doing the auroral study and get out. So we built 142-foot, I think it was, fully steerable, as a mount, rather crude structure because it only had to work at 400 megacycles. Put it up and then had to abandon it because it couldn't continue the funding. I understand that it's been since disabled and carried off to Germany.
Was that that lunar work published?
Yeah. Not under my name, though.
No, I don't have any later papers in 1960.
If you look up Liederbrand, though, he was the spark plug behind that, and he did manage to get some additional study money by that time I left.
Okay. So, was the attraction coming down here that finally you could do something beyond the moon, or what was the primary motivation for that AFC moon?
Plans. Yeah, something beyond the moon. I had... Bill Gordon invited me to come down here for on a 1 year's day, and he couldn't hit me at a better time. I had just finished writing a 640-page classified report on a thorough study of all the effects we saw from these rheometers scattered out of the Pacific. I was sick and tired of writing secret reports, which I knew would cut through them, right? Or knew one copy would be kept in Restburn.
Right.
And I wanted out, and he said, hey, why don't you come down to Arecibo for a year and work with Pettengill on whatever. And by golly, that was lots of fun, so we did. Right away that first year, the radar was just barely running in 1964. This machine was just barely running. We'd go up partway up the rails and the thing would stall. And something else would fry, and something else would not work. It would take the collector, you know, out of the solid wave and repair it. Down. We had a...
This is 63 now. 64.
But we were blessed with a good conjunction in June of that very year. So we had to really scurry. We did not have
on Venus
the technique of coherent Venus. We did not have the technique of coherent processing worked out at all, and we had to sort of program up and do that as fast as we could. We didn't have fast Fourier transforms that hadn't been invented yet, as far as we knew.
And what frequency were you at?
This is 430 degrees.
And what was the status of the Venus things? I know there were these claims, which, as you saw it at that time, what was it?
We were mainly after it, orbital information. For Venus, trying to get ranging on, because that was such disastrously bad shape. And there, what you want to do is get the largest data set, the biggest signal to noise you possibly can.
Right.
But still, we were dealing with rather long pulses, like millisecond, 2 millisecond pulse grids, and integrating for 5 minutes.
But by that time, did everyone have confidence that Venus had been detected?
Or wasn't any question about the detection. We were now after. In fact, at that time, I think JPL had said, hey, it's a retrograde orbit, fellas. And we came along and nailed down that fact, and we actually got
retrograde rotation.
Yeah. And we contributed a lot to nailing that down better, because we had much better signal to noise than they did.
Okay, well, at this point, you're getting much more involved in astronomy.
Well, if you call radar echoes from the planets astronomy.
Well, maybe I should ask you, were you involved in the interpretation of the orbits and so forth, or was that somebody else in the team?
No, this is mainly stuff that we shipped up to Herman Shapiro.
Nice.
He had a joint program. He would feed to us a working information, and he'd say, fellas, what's wrong with it? And we would feed back to him the residuals that we saw.
And then he wouldn't do
it. And it wasn't. Only shortly after, you do a best fit based upon all the optical data you get his hands on and all our radar data. Even some Russian data in there and put the whole thing together and do a best fit, and then he'd do a better job each year predicting what we'd see in the future.
Russian radar, were you referring to? Okay, so that then it seems like that in all the stuff you're doing, even up through the 60s, then you mainly consider that your contribution is going to the radar engineering side of it rather than to the interpretation of the physics and astrophysics and so forth.
I love to build things. I love to get new things about new systems up. And, was deeply involved in getting programming going, involved. At that time, we had a desk-sized CDC-160A computer with 4K memory and about a 16-bit word, I guess. 12-bit word.
For the entire Arecibo?
Yeah. This place, that didn't have digital processing in mind when it was built. And I remember we used to program on punch paper tape. And when you had to change your program, you had to reach on the floor with a pencil eraser and get out a little dot that you punched it and glue it back in. So.
Now, what was the primary purpose to build this?
To build Arecibo. Yeah. All those ionosphere
money. And it was the Air Force funded?
No, that was ARPA.
ARPA.
ARPA, it was called the Project Defender. Now, it had as goal trying to... Well, at that time, we were sort of hoping that we could detect ICBMs as they were being launched in Russia. We had hoped to see shockwaves, for example, propagate rapidly through the ionosphere and be seen by us on this side of the Earth so we could say, hey, something happened over there. Or we wanted to be able to look in the mirror of the ionosphere at HF and be able to see things happening having to do with, say, the plume of the rocket.
Right.
Leaving or something in that order. We were seeing at that time strange effects when rockets would leave the Cape, even at microwave frequencies, when the wake of the rocket behind the, when the wake of the shock passed parallel to the line of sight to the tracking station along the coast of Florida, they would lose the signal for a moment.
I didn't
understand that. Re-entry was not understood well. Why did these signals tend to black out? What a disastrous thing. Couldn't have picked a worse time to black out. It was right when we used to be doing it. And then when we had the chemical release... When we had the chemical release experiments, the barium release experiments, which would soak up and create a hole in the atmosphere. We didn't understand that very well. All of these things were... And we just realized... ARPA realized we didn't understand the atmosphere very well. And funded the construction of a very simple... radar, which would be incoherent scatter, and which would, I like to put it, it was the same, it's the analogy to an X-ray compared to a photograph. Up to then, we'd looked at the bottom side of the ionosphere pretty well, but we could not see through it, we could not see the top side, and the incoherent scatter would nicely answer that.
So it was a 1,000-foot dish, though, from the very beginning, right?
A 1,000-foot dish is an arbitrary number picked out of the hat, let's go build it. 430 megacycles, 400 to 450 megacycles was picked because that's where you get hardened, the Venus developments, big klystrons, big waveguide components were then becoming available in development.
ARPO is Advanced Research Projects Agency
of the Department of Defense. Right. And so the justification was sort of a blank, we want to understand the ionosphere better. But at the same time, there was the wisdom of the sponsoring agency to fund making it more steerable. It cost many more million to make that rotatable feed arm and those movable carriage houses and all that good stuff, which then made it possible to do radar astronomy. That was an obvious need, you see, and then you could happily track along as you looked at these planets. ARPA saw that, yes, that might want to be done. But then if you shut the transmitters off, you can use it for astronomy. And here we are spending most of our time doing now astronomy.
Well, of course, those were in the years when the Department of Defense didn't mind funding some basic research. So do I have the picture right that they wanted to see a goodly fraction of it go towards things that they had a direct interest in, but they didn't mind if some other fractions...
Yeah, they said, we'd be happy to, if you do 50% non-ionospheric things, it is okay with us. And this meant that we were able to get on board some pretty interested people. Interesting people who knew their business and would come down here and use this for radio astronomy and could thereby help calibrate the machine. See,
right.
end up radio point source is one of the best ways to calibrate the dish.
This is 64?
This is still 64.
Right, and who are these people?
Oh, Marshall Cohen was down here at that time. He was living down here. But they ended up living in South Africa. Kazes from Moudon.
So you were saying that Marshall Cohen and Kazes made important contributions in terms of...
Well, I don't want to say it that strongly. What was happening during 1964 was we were still trying to get this thing to run. We had incredibly... what were advanced things in those days, but it's incredibly crude now. So I think Kazes was here about a year. Marshall Cohen was here really too early. The thing wasn't really running well enough for him to use, so... A lot of our stuff was battling getting it going.
Mm-hmm. And how long was it before it really was sort of operating in a reasonably smoothly?
Well, I think late 64 it started got running. We had a very new Nuplintuck operation getting radar, it was during that summer from Venus. Of course, we had to have everything working. The transmitter had to work, the pointing had to work, the receivers all had to work.
And what did you find out from that Venus conjunction?
Oh, that was a pretty good one. We worked on rotation rate. We watched spots pass by, and, well, it was mainly a session of ranging on the front edge of the planet. We did a real good job of that. We worried a lot about the Doppler broadening that was going on, and how that width varied with a function of time. That's enough to get the, that if you fit that curve, that is enough to determine the pole in two angles and the spin rate.
And so you say the JPL has more or less gotten the retrograde rotation,
retrograde,
and you confirmed that, but did a lot more
on
the exact spin axis.
You know, we had a curve that had maybe 20 good points on it, really solid points, and by fitting that curve, you could really nail this thing down to a few degrees. Not very nearly perpendicular to ecliptic, things like that, which are surprises to us. I think it was later that we realized that this thing is in near synchronous orbit. That is, Venus turns one spot toward the Earth at each conjunction and does a bunch of spins in between. I don't know when we first realized that. We suspected it, I think, at that time. We weren't able to say it very loudly.
Well, and something else just came to my mind, but I didn't forget, is it was a couple years later when you and Pettengill found the Mercury.
That was a surprise. Rotation. 1965, of course, I didn't expect anything on that.
Well, you were just going for a detection from Mercury?
We were looking at Mercury with the point of view of ranging on it.
Had it been detected?
When did we detect Mercury? I think it was the previous year we managed to get echoes from it. They were very crude echoes, like 5 millisecond pulse widths and things like that. Mercury's a much harder target to get echoes from, smaller and further away all the time. So, but we did get these weak suggestions of echoes from following the leading edge. And it was kind of scary when we look back on it now, but we managed to get a couple of pulse widths worth of information from the planet back behind the initial pulse. And you can see, oh yes, it's spinning, because you can see the further back on the planet, it's broken into two lumps in the main. That's a consequence of the rings of constant range being parallel to the slices of constant frequency. So you get a large area in there, so you expect to get a couple of bumps. And Gordon was happily fitting these just to make sure everything fit properly, the 88-day rotation period, couldn't make it fit. And so we looked at that a little further and realized that, the best fit we came up with was something like 59 days. And at that time, I don't think we really appreciated the fact that it was awfully close to 58.xxx, which is 2/3 of 88. Fell upon the 59 just by looking at the data.
Yeah, well that's your job. And so it was some of the theorists who
Well, it's the optical people immediately got busy, and I remember Dolphus was with us fairly early in those days. Now, he sat at up in the Pyrenees with his, and he was the expert on the rotation rate of Mercury, because he had peered through this thing in the very thin atmosphere up there, and had looked at Mercury. And he would see dust storms on Mercury, he thought. There'd be times when you could get Mercury's an extremely hard object to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be just the right phase. Close to the sun, but above your own horizon, etc. Right. Et so you can only get brief glimpses, and it's a great tribute that they can do anything with that crazy planet optic. He would not see the familiar patterns, and so he would declare a dust storm or something, because things were different on there, and he would sort of stuff those under the desk. Every other conjunction, he was ending up stacking them in the bottom drawer of the file cabinet as being useless because of the damn dust storm. Well, when we pointed out that this rotation rate might not be, he fished these back out, and he saw, well, there was detail on these things, and the detail matched, so every other conjunction looked the same. This immediately unlocked it. And within months, there was papers out saying, look, this is precisely 2/3 rotation. Right. So on.
I see. So he essentially admitted that he didn't fit into his ideas, and so he just sort of ignored this.
Right. Isn't that the way science often goes?
Well, people don't often admit it.
He admitted to me privately, at least, I don't know.
When you got the 59-day period, did you have any trepidation in publishing it, since there was 80 years of going back to Schiaparelli, I think it was, of saying that it was an 88-day period?
Yeah. Well, that was a very short paper, and it was very quick. We put that thing out so fast we didn't even think about it.
Actually, no, which is probably good. If you thought about it some more, you would have been more nervous.
Right. I think it was, isn't that the way it goes? Sometimes the prettiest work... In my career, the two prettiest things that I like to look back on are the fact that I went up to Point Barrow and made this observation with extremely simple equipment, well north of the Aurora Zone. A very quick experiment, but quite convincing. And then there was this accidental discovery of the wrong rotation rate of Mercury, both of which could all be sort of boiled down on one or two pages. But they were quick, they were fast, they were out right away, and I think that's what turns me on.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's why I like being out on the cutting edge.
If you have to go too long and protest too much, then
that's sort of, I guess that you might say that's my style.
Yeah.
My style is cut through all the monkey business and do something right now, even though it might not be pretty, and then let somebody else follow up with the tedium. So that is one reason I'm leaving. I've sort of left radar astronomy. Because it got down to the point where we were worrying about the ups and downs and details of great areas of the Martian surface. And
you became cartographers.
Yeah, right. And I became Coastal Geodetic Survey on an astronomic scale and so on. Of course, I've missed out on a lot of fun reading these echoes from Jupiter, to the moons of Jupiter. Mm-hmm. I've missed out on that completely.
But now let's talk just about the overall development of radar astronomy, vis-a-vis radio astronomy and our optical astronomy. It seems to me that radar astronomy is a much more technique-oriented thing, even than radio astronomy, which is much more than optical.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
Sure would. All the time, our limits have been equipmental. Transmitter power has to be gotten adequate. The antenna has to point. You have to have lots of round-trip performance, you have to have the best possible receivers, and now data processing has to be right out there at the very edge, or you don't learn anything.
Mm-hmm. So it's been mainly, if the cleverness involved is not so much in the, or is this fair statement, that it's not so much in the interpretation of the data, but in being able to build a better and more powerful this or that, and then it sort of falls into place, what you get out of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. The building of a better and better machine tends to, you can read up all of the radar astronomy literature by just sitting down and doing it in a couple of weeks. You can sort of go back through all of it that's ever been published. You don't have to have a tremendous library to do that. So the advances in radar astronomy, well, there's some cleverness involved, isn't there, because you... like going into the frequency domain as well as the time domain in radar to some cleverness. And it's fortunate.
Yeah, how did that come about? I mean, was that flash that somebody had? Or
I think Paul Green at MIT gets credit mainly for that kind of thing, pointing out, look, you have a complicated target, and you ought to match your target, match your filters to the target. Mm-hmm. That was his approach to things. And Gordon Bettendorf, and that deserves all the credit for realizing what you can get out of all of this sort of thing. It ends up, in retrospect, is very similar to the side-looking radar, in which you deal with range and range rate. That's essentially what you're doing here.
Side-looking radar?
Side-looking radar is an airplane equipped.
Oh, to look up to the side.
And you look off to the side, and you look at, and you filter you get this great smear of stuff coming back and being recorded. And then you de-scramble it. Actually, we use optical de-scramblings to do the Fourier transform. You unscramble, and the coordinates that you map in are range and range rate, which translates Doppler.
Sure.
And you've seen what they've done. Well, radar astronomy is really a lot of that. Now we've gone off and built interferometers to get that third dimension out of the planets, namely the fact that the northern and southern hemisphere folded on top of each other with range and range rate technique.
Yeah. Now, let me ask, in terms of the think we discussed this before, but I'd like to get it on tape. Do you see it as being sort of a limited field, like meteor radar astronomy sort of died out in the late 55, mm-hmm. Late 50s. It had done its thing and mm-hmm. didn't look too promising. Do you see the same thing happening to radar astronomy eventually because it runs out of targets, or do you think that's being short-sighted?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Down through the times that I've been involved in it, we've sort of said, wow, that's the biggest radar that's ever going to get built. And the sponsoring agencies talk poor mouth, and it looks as though nothing will ever happen beyond it. And then, lo and behold, JPL maybe will get a bigger transmitter, and they'll do something better. Or they'll get a 210-foot dish, or they'll move to a higher frequency. All of these things are in the right direction. And Gordon used to have a slide which had the... It was the radar sensitivity.
Yes, I saw it
as a function of year.
Right.
The darn curve was linear.
Yeah.
And you'd say, wow, and we'd never make it. And there was a point there for Sugar Grove, and I had to X that point out and so on. I don't know whether we're still on that curve, but we've certainly here at RC we've made some big advances in sensitivity now. And I'm afraid left people behind. I think down through the history, it has been healthy to have JPL out there acting as competition for us. They make a step ahead, they beat us. We make a step ahead and we beat them. And it's been healthy for everybody to have us both in stiff competition and neck and neck. It's important to be neck and neck. If you're not, it doesn't work very well.
Right.
Unfortunately, they're both in the U.S. There's not been a lot of cross-mixing in these two camps.
Jodrell hasn't really done anything since...
Jodrell shut down when John Evans left, you see.
That long ago, but yeah. And did the Russians do anything?
And the Russians have done nothing, as far as I can remember, since 1965. Period. Done. Finished. Wrapped up. None. Nothing.
Why is this? Why is the U.S. the only country that...
Well, the JPL people have gotten ahead because they've been able to test, you might say, space communication systems, but on the side do a little basic research and do with planetary services. That's really the justification for a lot of the money that gets spent with it. It's really equipmental development that you might as well mm-hmm. do something useful with it that is not associated with spacecraft. That's sort of the way that's gone on. And now it's kind of awkward because here we are at Arecibo and we have we're about the only machine that can do this. There's a little bit of thing still going on at JPL, but even they're coming down here to use this kind of machine, and I think that's unhealthy.
There only be one place doing radar astronomy
That's too bad. What if we're making a mistake or something?
Yeah. See,
there's no check on it. What if we're taking the wrong approach and missing something? There's no check. There's no competition.
It's not unusual, of course. I mean, it happens all the time with the biggest and best instrument.
Yes. Well, with a visitor program, we can have people come down here and make observations, and they'll say, hey, I want to look at such and such. There's been some awkwardness there because JPL will sometimes want to look at an asteroid that some graduate student wants to look at, and so you have to be a little careful. But I guess that's the way it goes.
Does the visitor program work in the radar? It would seem to me like it'd be much trickier than the...
It is trickier, a lot trickier. The way it's usually been working in the past is that people at MIT who feed us ephemerides data and are helpful in reducing ours, and we're fairly willing to bare our souls to them and so on, will join with us in a joint observation, and a person will come down at the right time to participate here or to generate a program or to carry back data for analysis or something like that. There's been some people who have come from JPL, but they don't really believe it. We've had a hard time convincing them, put in a proposal and you can come down and use it. And they say, I won't write a proposal because you probably will not approve it, and so how can I come and use it? So,
do you accept it? You've done it the week before or something?
Yeah, and that's kind of too bad. Mm-hmm. I think that we could... The question is, are there more targets to look at? Well, the trouble is range to the fourth bar. It does get you in a rapid way here.
And of course, you're looking at smaller objects all the time. You're running out of the big ones.
Yeah, well, Jupiter and Saturn are still sitting out there.
There's an awful lot of mapping work to be done, of course. We'll take literally a decade or two.
Yeah. That's right.
Don Campbell was... He obviously knows the Venus conjunctions all the way through the 80s in his head.
That's right. And we've talked about putting more than one base lineup at the same time, which would be useful to do it. Dear.
Well, I think that covers it pretty well, unless you have some other thoughts about development of radar astronomy as you've seen it.
Well, a lot of credit goes, speaking from my own point of view, a lot of credit goes to Gordon Pettengill, who has really been my mentor in the radar astronomy business.
What exactly do you think are his main contributions?
Well, every time I turn around, he's got another good idea about how we could either modify our instrumentation, like, say, coding the pulse, for example, to get the effect of higher peak power without transmitting a higher peak power.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, swap time domain for frequency domain and things like that. So that's been always true ever since I've been around here. He's always said, hey, why don't we do this? And he'll say, with this, by modifying this little way, we can do this, that, and so on. And that's been a hard guy to keep up with. He does a really great job.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That ends the interview with Rolf Dice at Arecibo on 23rd September 1977, and this is the end of this side of the tape.